Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Zaxby's Sensation Salad is so much more than a plain old salad. It's a salad, which begs the question, at what point does a salad stop being a salad and become a salad? Is it when you add Zaxby's fried chicken to it? Crunchy wontons? Asian slaw? Citrus vinaigrette? Teriyaki glaze? Sweet and spicy sauce? Or is it when you top it all with a handmade perfectly fried egg roll? Without a doubt, the egg roll. The Sensation Salad. Only at Zaxby's.
I mean, there's a reason why most of us writers are writers, which is that, like, we like being alone. I think actually the greatest fear would be something like what happened to Game of Thrones, that it would be like, at some point someone invites you onto a podcast and says, how did your career move so quickly and what's the secret to your success?
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Two to Ramble podcast. I am one of your hosts, Austin.
I'm your other host, Richard.
Today, we are absolutely honored to have Fonda Lee on as a guest. For those that don't know Fonda Lee, she's the writer of the Green Bone Saga, the first book being Jade City. And she's not just that. She also has black belts in, is it Kung Fu and Karate? You have an MBA. You've done all sorts of things. Writing's like a side hobby, and you've made it work and made it work beyond what you could probably ever imagine. It's awesome. We're so happy to have you on and talk about a couple themes like, hey, this rapid rise to fame now, just your personal life versus writing. How does it work, the day in the life of an author? How you build your worlds, all sorts of stuff. Fonda, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me on. Good to be here.
Absolutely. I guess, Rich, for our first topic of interest here, where do you want to start? I'll let you start the ground game and we'll build our way up.
Well, Fonda, would love to hear from your own words on how you kind of got started into this industry. Because from the outside looking in, your trajectory was just exponential. There's plenty of stories of different authors of, you know, they write their first book, or, you know, Sanderson, he writes, 13, 17 novels, and then one finally picks up. But seems with you, like Jade City, just huge explosion of success. And you want to tell us a little bit about your story of from beginning to Greenbone Saga?
Actually, from when your childhood to Greenbone Saga.
Yeah.
Like every detail
go through. Yeah.
Right. So I was born. I won't go quite that far back. But it's really funny for me to sit here and listen to you say that, because I think from the outside looking in, oftentimes a writing career does seem like it happens overnight, right? Like a book comes out and people are like all talking about this book. But from the inside, as the person who's actually going through it, it is nothing like that. It is very much a like slow grind, a slog, a lot of detours and obstacles, and just it's very much like the 10-year overnight success, right? I remember at one point I read a blog post by V.E. Schwab, and this was back in the days when I was like just getting started in the publishing industry. And she had hit the New York Times bestseller list, and she had written a blog post about the slow 10-year overnight success. And now when I go back and read that post, I'm like, it's so true, because there's so much that happens to even be able to get a book finished, get an agent, get a book deal, see that book through the publication, much less like actually see your book successful out in the market and make a full-time career out of it. My story as a writer starts pretty early. I was always just a voracious reader. So I was that nerdy kid who was in the school library reading fantasy novels after like class was out and closed down the library and then went home with a stack of books. So I was into fantasy and science fiction at a really young age. But I did not ever think that writing could be a real career. I thought that, you know, I have to grow up and go to college and get a good job and, you know, support myself and all that. So
not become like a podcaster, right?
Terrible.
Yeah, all these jobs that, like, you know, your parents, they're like, well, you can't make a living playing video games. No, I know several people who make a living. Right. You can't make a living playing D&D. Yeah, you can.
Actually, today, so, yeah.
Yeah, like, I love that, like, you know, the irony of it now that there's so many of us doing jobs in creative fields that our parents told us could not actually support us.
But you thought that growing up, like, how can I actually be a writer, yeah, right? Is that feasible?
Yeah, definitely. Especially since fantasy back then was much more narrow than it is now. The fantasy that I grew up reading when, you know, was the that all that like sort of vaguely medieval European swords and sorcery kind of stuff, which I loved, but I didn't really see like myself necessarily reflected in. I certainly didn't know any authors who were like me. So I kind of just sort of assumed that, you know, authors were sort of this, I don't know, this strange breed of humans. They weren't, you know, wasn't something that I could aspire to necessarily. And I remember like always having this pipe dream though of like, oh, I really want to write a book. Like I love writing books. I love writing stories. I had this really long bus ride with like, you know, no Game Boy, nothing to do really, no phone to scroll through. So I just had a like spiral bound notebook and just wrote stories in it. So I just always treated it like a hobby. You know, grew up, went to college, got a degree in finance of all things, and did management consulting, worked in corporate strategy, and then had this period in my life where I kind of had like a crisis because, I had to decide, what to do next in my career. I was sort of at this inflection point where my boss was asking me, well, what do you want to do next? Mm-hmm. You know, you're kind of like on that promotion, trajectory and like, do you want to go into like general management? Do you want to try like transition laterally? Like, what do you want to do? And, at the time, I was pretty much not writing at all. My like life was just too busy. Mm-hmm. As I was going through all these like career visioning exercises, I just kept coming back to, I really miss writing. I used to write all the time. I used to love it. Why can't I do that anymore? So, rather than like double down on my day job career, I was like, well, I'm going to try and actually pull back on the day job and find some more time in my life to do something I actually want to do. So I started taking myself seriously as a writer, actually trying to, you know, join writing classes, get my work critiqued, finish a full manuscript. And granted, this was like early, this was probably around 2010. Yeah. So, you know, a solid 5 years before I was published and 7 years before Jade City came out. Right. And so at this point, I was still juggling the day job, my family, trying to get some writing in there. I remember taking like online classes where I would read and write and critique on the weekends or on evenings. I completed a kind of practice novel that didn't really go anywhere. Then I completed an entire full manuscript that I started querying and that didn't go anywhere. And I was still querying that when I wrote a science fiction novel called Zero Boxer. And that's the book that ended up getting picked up. I got an agent, I got a book deal with a small press publisher for like a very modest sum of around, I think it was $5,000. And that was my first book. Awesome. But you know, at that point I was deep into it and I just have the personality where it's like, if I've decided I want to do something, then I go whole hog. So at that point I was like, how do I do less and less of my day job and find a way to make this work?
What was the point where you did quit? And was it when Jade City hit the top 100 times best fantasy books of all time?
But no, I quit before then.
Before that. Okay. So you knew it was coming. You said, I know I'm on the list. Let's.
No, I like jumping out of airplanes without parachutes, apparently, career-wise.
I love that.
So, quit I believe around when my second book came out, which was Exo.
Okay.
The fiction novel. Awesome. And then not long after I got the deal for Jade City. And I was on contract for a second book, the sequel to EXO as well. So everything kind of started to sort of snowball around then. But when Jade City actually came out, which was late 2017, it was by no means an immediate success. Like, it was not an instant, you know, New York Times bestseller. It was not like, you know, it didn't immediately get like optioned for television. It definitely did not give off any signs of being, a successful book. I mean, it certainly got some critical acclaim right out of the bat, which was really nice and gave me confidence that the trilogy would be completed and that it would have some readership. And fortunately for me, I also had an editor who was very passionate about the books, who championed them, who got, you know, the 3-book deal for me. So I was like, great. This is like, at the time I was thinking this is great because it's almost like debuting again. I had debuted with a science fiction novel. And at that point I had 3 young adult science fiction novels out. So moving into my adult fantasy debut, it felt like another little like burst of energy, which is always great in the publishing industry. But I certainly had no sense of whether or not, you know, the Greenbone Saga would take off. And it was like a very much a slow burn, word of mouth trilogy. And I really noticed it's starting to pick up after the second book came out, Jade War. And then there was a readership that was eager for the 3rd book. And then once the trilogy was complete, I think more and more people discovered it.
That's amazing. You have your newest book coming out is being co-written by Bruce Lee's daughter, Shannon. It's called Breath of the Dragon. It's a book 1 of a new series. Is that correct? That comes out January 7th for those who want to check that out. We'll have a link in the description below. But this is your newest project, newest series, because you're done with Greenbone for the moment.
Yeah.
Anything more going to happen in that universe?
Not in the near future.
Okay.
So after the Greenbone Saga was done, I stuck around in the world a little longer, did a spin-off novella with different characters, did some prequel short stories. And then it was like, I gotta move on to some of these other ideas I have.
Yeah.
So I wrote another novella called Under the Sky. Basically, I was temporarily burned out on the big, thick doorstopper novels.
Yeah.
So I wrote a bunch of novellas, short fiction. And then this project, the duology, that starts with Breath of the Dragon that comes out in January, kind of fell in my lap. Honestly, I didn't have plans to write it, but I got approached by Shannon, and I've been a Bruce Lee fan my whole life. And
so cool.
This is just a cool opportunity. So
how did that connection happen between you and Bruce Lee's daughter?
It was a call out of the blue. 100%. Yeah. She had read my work. She had been wanting to turn her father's script treatments into something new, into a fantasy novel that could be accessible to like a new generation of people who weren't as familiar with Bruce Lee. And she reached out to me, and then we got on a call, and you know, when you get, when your agent's like, oh, Bruce Lee's daughter would like to talk to you, you pick up the phone. So
yes. Just when you heard 2 Rambles reaching out, like, oh my God, how do I make that work in my schedule? we could tell the urgency.
Yeah, exactly like that, guys.
And just before we continue, quick break from our sponsor, World Anvil. We'll be right back in a minute.
Hey, do you want to be cooler than Joe Abercrombie? And actually good, you know, by giving your readers maps.
Like Fonda Lee. So actually give your reader a map. Well, go to worldanvil.com. You can create maps, cultures. You can build a world in their easy-to-use web browser. Also looking at characters and creating characters' flaws, wants, and needs. Anything you really need to structure and map out your story, World Anvil provides all these tools you can use for completely free. Check out the link in the description below. use all of these tools at your will. And if you like the system, if you like to use worldanvil.com, you can use our code RAMBLE, that's RAMBLE, for 51% off of a yearly subscription. So go check it out for absolutely free. Click our link in the description below. Supports us, supports them. We're very thankful for them sponsoring us. And go be cool like Fonda Lee and not lame like Joe Abercrombie. That rhymes.
There you go. You got it.
Again, say it with me. Rhyme
cool
with
cool like Fonda Lee.
And not.
Not lame. Like, not uncool.
Like
not
Joe
stupid.
Abercrombie. Yeah. That's perfect. Just, yeah. Rhyme World Anvil.
World Anvil and.
We're back to the episode. Very important question, since we were just talking about Bruce Lee's daughter and you have a black belt in both Kung Fu and Karate. And I have those correct. It wasn't.
Yes, that's
okay.
Yeah.
Now, have you seen the film The Raid?
Of course I have.
Okay. You are a qualified expert then. You've passed the test.
The black belt is like, okay, maybe. But you've seen The Raid. That means you're qualified to talk about it.
And The Raid 2?
I have.
Which do you like better? And do you like the films as well? I mean,
I do. I enjoy the films. I mean, they're just manic, right? Like, yes. I remember absolutely nothing about the plot.
No,
oh, the first no, one, there is no plot.
You know they're fighting. I mean, they're fighting their way, you know, up a building.
Yep.
But like, that's all that you need to know.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's it. That's all. Do you have some favorites?
Absolutely. So the sheer quantity of Silat knife fighting is just like it's a wonder to behold.
Right.
So. For me, the movies were hard to find online of just. I think it was on one of the streaming platforms, like The Raid 2, but it was only in English dub. That was it.
Oh,
couldn't find it. And it didn't sound good. The dub was not particularly good.
No.
So I had to buy the Blu-ray from China get it.
Always do the sub. Always.
Yeah. It was worth buying that. But the first movie, like, I think they clearly knew what they were doing of just, hey, look, they're fighting through a building. They're trying to escape a build. That's it. The second movie had a plot. Like, there were some ideas there, and that's where it was. Right. I don't know. It was interesting. It got more ridiculous somehow, and they tried to make it an actual movie plot, not just one long fight scene. So,
yeah.
Do you appreciate those kind of films, or what are your favorite? I guess just because you do karate and kung fu doesn't mean you have to like those kind of films, but I imagine you have some interest in them. Do you have some favorites, and is that your favorite type? Is that why you wrote also in that you kind of like that atmosphere in your books as well?
I mean, I certainly appreciate them.
Okay.
Right. I love an action packed movie, but I go in with like the appropriate expectations, right? Like I, especially for The Raid, I was like, I don't expect there to be, you know, a coherent character arc. Like, I'm not looking for that.
So compelling.
Yeah, I know going in, like I'm here for like just the quantity of violence. But I actually, my preferred genre is actually what I'd say like smart action. Like I love movies that are pretty high octane but have, you know, really intelligent plot. And ideas and cool world building. Like I, for example, I love Mad Max Fury Road.
Oh, that's one top three film for me.
You know, one of the most goated movies.
I feel seen. I feel seen.
Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon.
Haven't seen that. So you'd highly recommend?
I do.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. I'm so far, I'm liking your list, so I'm going to have to add that as well.
Yeah. So,
writing it down.
Yes.
Yes.
It is down.
So I love a good, the first John Wick, right? Like the sheer amount of world building that's done around like this concept of, you know, a chain of just luxury murder hotels. I love the aesthetic that's put in, you know, so I do like action films that aren't, my preference is for action films that also have really cool concept, really cool aesthetic, really great characters, memorable characters,
right.
And some, you know, some great ideas. And I like, for example, I love science fiction action movies too. Like, of course, Aliens, Minority Report were my favorite movies. So like there's a lot of I try to. I think what I love in those films is that like full package of characters, world building, action. And that's very much like the ethos I try to bring into my books.
Give some good characters and some cool stabby, stabby, punch, punch along the way. And you're in for a good time.
Absolutely. Yeah. I guess for those inspirations you're seeing, just films you love, books you've loved in the past, and to where you are now, so Greenbone was optioned at one point, which doesn't mean it was going to get made, but it wasn't an option with Peacock at a certain point, and now it's back to the drawing board, but you're in that space. I guess, is that kind of a surreal moment of going, wow, my series, my books are actually going to be adapted, could be adapted, and probably will be, I imagine. I don't know if you want to drop any news on us, but.
Yeah, I mean, it was very cool. But one thing that you realize after a while, after books get optioned, is that like nothing happens. I mean, that's kind of the sad reality. Is like 95-96% of the time, nothing happens. But it is very cool to start going down that path and to imagine. So it was the books were optioned. They were in development at Peacock. There is out there like a sizzle reel of like conceptually where they were going with the series. You know, there's concept art that I got to look at. There were scripts that I got to look at. So it was really cool. It was fun to imagine.
Yeah.
Obviously it didn't happen at Peacock. It's since been reoptioned. We're in talks for it to maybe go somewhere now. But who knows? Who knows? But as a writer, I mean, as a novelist in particular, I think one of the things that, you know, I always just come back to is that like, I can only control the books. Like the books to me are they're canon. Right. Yeah. And the movie, the films, if they ever, or the show, if it ever gets made, would be its own thing. Like that's someone else's creative baby and they're gonna, you know, have their own take on how it should unspool, what the characters would be like. And as the author of the books, I don't have like a ton of control over that. So I'm one of those people who's always going to have the shirt that says the book is better. That's just, it's not always the case, but most of the time it is.
I'm trying to think of a case where the opposite is true. And yeah, I don't have a single one.
Arguably.
You would say Lord of the Rings. Well,
Princess Diaries is arguable too.
Okay, that's also true.
That's such a fun film, but
there are films that you don't realize are books where the film is better. So, for example, like Die Hard is based on a book.
That I would have, right? I would have never thought so.
Yeah, exactly. Jaws.
Oh, that's right.
Oh, yeah. So there's definitely cases where the film is better.
Yeah. Jurassic Park.
That's a
book, it is a book, but I'm wondering.
Yeah.
I haven't read the book actually, but I mean the movie is amazing. So
the book is quite good. Is great too, but I think the film was just so groundbreaking that I'd have to give the nod to the film.
Well, what would be your biggest fear as an author of a book, going into the process of making a movie and an adaptation of your works? What would be your greatest fear that would happen?
So funny enough, my greatest fear is not that it would suck, because that happens.
Sure.
You know? And honestly, like, I think if it sucked a lot, if it was just a complete hot mess, steaming pile of garbage, then I could be like, that has nothing to do with my book, right? I could just kind of write it off and be like, yeah, that happened, but you know, it's not, has nothing to do with me. I think actually the greatest fear, sorry to say, would be something like what happened to Game of Thrones, that it would be like, it would be close enough to my books and be promising to start, but then like, ruin them. Like it would supplant the books in a bad way.
Yeah.
That's I think my fear, or that they would just like completely, you know, just butcher the characters and the themes in a way that that I didn't agree with. But you know, I wouldn't have been the first author to have gone through something like that.
Yeah, there's almost something. I understand your point of if it just was awful, then it could write it off. It's not. Yeah. It doesn't adopt the identity of the thing that you created. Versus if it's good enough, like there's almost a disappointment where it's not awful, but it's also not great. And so when people mention it, they're thinking of the movie or the TV show rather than the book. Yeah. And that just kind of gets sad. I know for me personally, think about like The Martian. When people mention that, the first thought most people go to is, oh yeah, the movie. And it's good. It's a good movie.
Yeah.
I just think the book is just so much better. And it's disappointing a little bit to me of like, that's the people's first thoughts of it. And that's their impression.
Versus Aragon.
Yeah.
Nobody thinks of the movie going, oh, it's like the book. Because
that's kind of my nervous. It happened a few times with like Wheel of Time of I don't like the show. But when I mention it, a few people have gone like, oh, yeah, I watched that show. It's okay. And that's just like that hurts me of the it's okay rather than
your favorite
bad.
Series. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Right. I mean, now that you've got me thinking about it, I think my other fear is that it would just especially because, you know, I write books that have inspiration from Asian cultures and histories, that they would just like F it up. Like they would just become like horribly exoticized and become like, you know, the Disney version of Mulan or something like that. That would be the other failure scenario that I would not want to see.
Speaking of cultures and everything, I'm kind of curious to ask you about how exactly you go about creating a world with existing cultures, where like, how much do you take? How much do you change? How do you change without maybe bastardizing it? How do you take without maybe just, that's just Japan, but in your world? How do you go about that delicate balance of respecting a culture, but also, you know, making it yours?
Yeah. I mean, the reason why I love writing fantasy, right, is that I'm not beholden to accuracy, which is like, it's great. Like I'm very much in the school of like, do enough research, but don't let it become a straitjacket, right? Like I don't ever pretend that this is a specific country in the world or a specific culture at a specific time with the serial numbers rubbed off. I am trying to create something that is its own secondary world, and I want it to feel like a secondary world, that it's not just, oh, I just transplanted, you know, one culture or one country and moved it over. And the way I did that was I very much wanted to like create those textural clues for the reader so that you know you're in an East Asian inspired world, in the example of the Green Bone Saga. Where, you know, I'm mentioning the food, for example, or some of the names of the places, the way the names of the people, the architecture, the, you know, everything that's like tangible in the story world will clue you that, okay, you're like in an East Asian setting, but I don't lean to specifics that are going to like tie it down. So you'll notice like in the Green Bone Saga, I never actually use the word like kimono or katana or like dim sum or, you know, anything that's like obviously like, oh, well, this is in our world. And if I'm going to describe a dish, I don't call it, you know, I'm not going to call it something really specific to our world. I'm going to just describe it in a way that makes it clear, like, oh yeah, this is like an Asian dish. Oh, like this, you know? And so, that makes it, I hope, have this feeling of like, oh, this is recognizable. This is clearly like in the neighborhood of like real places that I know and recognize, but it's also clearly different because it has magic jade, right? It's like so much of that culture and so much of that world is built around a speculative element. And then I say I had even more of a challenge doing that when I wrote like this one novella, Untethered Sky, which is based on ancient Persia, which is the setting. And the reason why it's based in ancient Persia is because it's around, the story revolves around rocks and manticores, which are mythological creatures that originate in ancient Persian mythology. So of course it made sense for it to be in ancient Persia. But that's not a culture that I am personally familiar with. So it involved a lot of research, and it involved a lot of, just making sure that I got all the kind of the nomenclature, the textural details that would have been accurate to that time period in there, without leaning on specifics. Like I never use actual real world historical characters. I made sure that it was always the characters and the world is treated just as respectfully as authentically as I possibly can.
Well, bringing it back to your greatest fear on, adaptation maybe mucking up the Asian inspired culture and all this. As a writer, what are some of the things that you see that's pretty easy to muck up? What's some of the, what do you see where you go oh, if I mess this part up, that'll just really ruin the culture? What have you either seen in your own work that you try to avoid when writing, or seen in others?
I think probably the easiest way to muck it up is to lean too heavily into stereotypes or into cultural templates in a way that just makes everything kind of feel like a caricature or like an archetype, what's a good example I come up with? Let's say, there's a story and it features Asian characters and they just are it's constant talk of filial piety and obedience and honor. And there are, of course, those concepts are in my books. They are a part of Asian culture. But if you have, if you kind of press on them too hard with the authorial thumb, where it's oh, that's just what all these, these characters are so, that's all they care about. That's their defining characteristic. Then they become archetypes, right? I think maybe the way to examine this is imagine, someone outside of American culture were to try and write a story set in American high school, and all the characters are just cardboard cutouts of what you imagine American high schoolers are like, right? There's this dumb meathead jock, and that's all he does. He's he's the football quarterback, and then there's this blonde preppy cheerleader, and then there's a nerd. And that's it, right? That's all they are. That's all that they're defined by. You're going to be this person has watched movies set in American high schools, but has never actually been through an American high school themselves.
Yeah, so
ever seen Steven Spielberg's Fablemans, The Fablemans? Have you ever watched it?
I haven't.
Oh, Rich, it's the scene. We saw it. It was the scene with the bully and the volleyball scene.
Oh, yeah.
I wish we could pull that up. It is Spielberg, so I think it's intentional. He's better than that. It's a bit
of it's one thing if it's clearly satire, right? If it's but if you're doing it straight, if you're I'm going to try and write something that feels deep and literary, but all these characters are just stereotypes. It's another thing if it's being played for laughs, because it's so obviously.
I wish we had a function. Could we pull that up? Is there a way?
I mean, we could, but then that requires.
Oh, you have to do some. You know what?
I'd have to look it up. We'd have to pause.
That's our next goal. Next time we'll have some technical capabilities, because I would want to see Fonda's reaction. Oh, it'd be so funny.
If you want to pause? I can pull it up.
Fonda, do you want to see it?
Sure.
Okay. Well, we'll be right back. Okay. We're back to that episode. That was a quick cut. We just took 27 minutes of Fonda Lee's time to find this clip. So Fonda, here's the hyped up volleyball scene from The Fablemans, the most niche film. All right, Rich, if you want to go ahead and play.
Nice. Atta baby, Logan. again. Go again. Good work, guys. Keep the intensity. Keep moving. Rotate. Nice, Jake. Good job, man.
Tableman. Oh, a little bowling scene. See that?
Bully.
A lot of cannon. Let's go, surf.
Cool it.
I did not mean to do that. Are you okay?
That really hurt, man.
Watch your mouth, Logan.
And scene. It gets more corny, but you could see by the fight, if you could hear that audio, where comes up to him, gives the, oh, you just rattled my chains, and the staring look and going, hey, cool it. I think that's what we were talking about with those, the in-your-face high school stereotypical scene.
Yeah. So this is actually entertaining to me because my son is an avid volleyball player.
Yes.
And so I need to... I'm sure he has not ever seen this scene. And now I have something I can show him. And be like, oh. Hey, look!
How old's your son?
He's 15.
Okay. I was going to say, because the film, I don't remember the film being
it's
that.
High school volleyball player. Yeah.
Exactly. That is now who knows if Spielberg, what Spielberg was going for there. It's a strange film, but it's just a very niche reference to the problem you're talking about, where you don't want to exaggerate something. And be, is that the right word to use? Exaggerating a culture to make it so on the nose, so in your face that it just comes across as
said of it's that the culture starts bleeding into, like, that's all the characters are, is a part of their culture rather than on their own. Is let's say someone does, they fix that problem, you know, like, okay, the characters are unique, the characters are more than just the culture they're from. What is a specific element of the background culture that you feel that you should get right? And what's something you can probably just, like, I can be a little bit more loose with that. Like, something came up in your research and you went, oh, I got to make sure I get this correct, versus something else where you go, I don't need to include that. It's fine. I'll change that one up.
Yeah. Yeah. As you said, like, fully realized characters who aren't just, you know, cookie cutter representations of some stereotypical perception of their culture is certainly a good starting point. And then the other thing too, is I think, what you do have to get right is the values, the principles, the moral frame of that culture, right? So the other thing that really just, like, sticks out as being inauthentic or wrong is when you make characters, you put characters in a culture or a time and a place that feels like you've just transplanted a 21st century, you know, American teenager, young person into that world, right? And like, I can't think of, like, a specific example off the top of my head, but I've certainly had that experience where it's like, okay, but this person sounds like they hold the values and they think and talk like a 20 something from, you know, modern day America, but they live in ancient Rome. And you're like, no, you know, if you live in ancient Rome, slavery is just a thing. Like, it's a part of your day-to-day life.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't be, you know, you wouldn't be reacting to it the way that a 21st century American would. Human sacrifice was just a thing at certain times of our human history in certain cultures.
Saving money now during Menards bag sale. All prices after 15% bag sale discount. Pick up a 6-pack of LED light bulbs for just $2.97. Get a wood or fiberglass claw hammer for only $2.29 each. 52-ounce bottles of Ajax dish soap, just $2.97. And 12 packs of Shasta soda in assorted flavors are only $4.19. Don't miss out on Menards bag sale happening now. Good through January 12th. See store for complete details.
Save big money at Menards.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details. At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Forced marriage, or there were so many things in our world that don't exist or aren't accepted now, that I think if you are trying to write authentically for a specific culture or time period, you have to reorient yourself around, yeah, like, well, what's the moral frame of these people? Like, what's their day to day?
I'm so sorry to get you in this trouble. Can I make a complaint? The Dune films, do you love the Dune films like everybody in their right mind does?
I love the Dune films.
So me and my man, Christopher Rocchio. Do you know Rocchio as well?
So I just met him at Dragonsteel.
Yeah, we had dinner with him. Awesome, awesome guy. He's so cool. And we were bonding. Mr. Rocchio and I, we were bonding over, he had some complaints about Dune. I'll let him speak for himself. But something we were bonding over was a bit of that modernity thing. Maybe this is more my complaints, but with the Dune films, and we can go off this, I know you love the films, but with the Bene Gesserit and how it works in the Dune books and their control and their how they plan this all out and have the Fremen and this belief around the Quasi-Cataract and all this. And then the film kind of takes a little bit modern twist where the Fremen have multiple, they're skeptics, and it's more of a modern, like some believe, some don't. Like Zendaya and the characters there are showing more modern takes on belief. And it took me out of it a little bit because I'm going like, okay, that's definitely valid to think today. I just don't, when I'm envisioning Dune and going back there. It was one of my complaints about, and I know there's worse takers against this, but that's the first that came to mind for me. And you don't have to agree with that, but I do agree with your point about kind of taking, okay, you're taking a modern sense in like a place where, of course, well, back then human sacrifice was a daily thing. Why would you all of a sudden, unless it made sense in the story, but to your point, that's what came to mind for me as a minor complaint about Dune. I always have to get my gripes into things that people love. That's what keeps this podcast running and the juice flowing.
Anything that Timothy Chalamet touches, you're that, just against.
I'm very general. Envious of the man. The boy, he doesn't deserve it. I'm very envious. And you know when somebody does something that's okay, so fine, it's a little joke on here, but Timothy, something about him, just when I see him in films, he's not in the most of the films I like, but I joke about not liking him, but there's truth to jokes. And so when Timothy did something really fun and cool, where there was a Timothy Chalamet lookalike contest in New York City, they were having a get together. Timothy wasn't a part of it, but he showed up part of the contest on the lookalike contest of people trying to look like Timothy Chalamet. It was such a funny thing. And I hated it when your enemy does something that makes them human and admirable. It's, you ever have that where you just go like, I want to hate this guy, but they do something, they make a funny joke, and you're like, damn, that was funny. Or dang it, they did something good. And it's just that a bit of when you watch somebody, you want them to fall, but they, I guess that's a lot of Rich and I on here. Like when we push back and forth, and when you see your brethren do something.
I can't wait to rate your book one star.
Oh, it's going to be.
I'm looking forward to that day.
Yeah, we have a lot of tension here, Fonda. Sorry.
Actually, I'm actually waiting for your book to just contain like a lot of underhanded Timothy Chalamet references. So that's what I'm going to be.
If I don't see this.
I didn't know that this was such a, you know, a long running.
It's what defines us, really.
It really is.
So all
actually, that I wanted to wrap that around to a question about books.
Is it related somehow?
Yeah.
Oh, that's beyond me. Good luck
with you and Timothy Chalamet. The trick of a character you really hate, and you make him do something. Go, oh, now I like him a little bit. I didn't want to like them. Have you ever tried to do that with a character where you deliberately make a character supposedly on all facets? Like, you know, if they're in ancient Rome, like, they're an advocate of slavery. They all the things that they shouldn't believe. And yet, is it fun just like, I'm going to try and make you like them? Do you try and plan that out with some of your characters of, on paper, this character shouldn't be likable. You won't agree with them, but I'm going to make them do something that gets you.
I feel like I do that with all my characters, honestly.
Oh, yeah.
I think there's elements of all my characters that are unlikable to some extent. I mean, maybe not all of them. Anden is pretty likable. But I think that like there are a number of my characters where, yeah, like I want to remind you that, and there's certainly times in the series that I deliberately remind you that these characters do things that certainly by our standards are pretty deplorable. But they're your protagonists. So if I've done my job right, you're going to be rooting for them. And then I have characters like there's one character in particular in the series Barrow that my readers hate. Like, and it brings me immense pleasure. Yeah. And I like the fact, I mean, at least I've certainly heard from some of my readers that they grudgingly come to accept and like maybe even sympathize with this character. And that makes me very happy.
That has to be cool to see. I guess, is it cool to see as well that people have different favorites? Do you have a universal everybody loves Anden, or do you see a
split? I mean, Hilo.
Oh, Hilo is very polarizing.
He's my favorite.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. Anden was the most fascinated with it. To also give context.
Yeah.
Only read Jade City. Oh, yeah, moving on to Jade War here pretty soon.
Yeah.
Okay.
The character I'm the most excited for, of course, is Anden, which,
yeah.
I mean, to the people who've read the book, kind of know why.
And but, yeah. The book, we didn't love the book as well. So we are curious because this happens all the time where we read a book one, the book two gets us. And all of our patrons in the book club are like book two, even people that liked book one enough, or even that didn't like book one said book two was so much better. So we're upset that we couldn't finish the trilogy before having you on, because we would have loved to finish it and then have the whole context.
We could do, but we could do multiple.
We'll just have you back on next week, the week after. So we're going to keep this going.
It takes a little longer than that to read the rest of the books.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, no, I mean, that happened with Empire of Silence with Christopher Rocchio. I liked the first one well enough. Like, it was good.
I didn't like it. And we just had dinner with him.
Yeah, and then we read book two, and then looking back, there are so many book ones that feel almost disconnected from the rest of their series. And I wonder if, Fonda, do you maybe see, like, is there a reason for that? Is that because maybe it's a new author and, like, it's not the same for you because you've written other books before Jade City, but is there like a first book curse?
First book syndrome?
Yeah. I don't know. Just a lot of series that come to mind. Some of my favorite stuff, the book one is definitely not the best. And I was convinced to read on. I don't know.
I don't know. I mean, I feel like I'm on here prematurely. I should wait until you guys.
That's true. So. That's true. Okay.
Verdict.
Yeah.
But I mean, I honestly don't think that's it. I think it's just because there's the book one, you're still getting to know the world. You're still getting to know the characters. And I think there are stories, especially ones that are like sprawling epic space operas or, you know, big epic fantasies where the scope of the story is such that you're really not going to see the full picture until you're through book one and into book two or even later. Yeah. I can also think of TV shows. I can think of, you know, film series where it's like, maybe the first installment is feels more like a slow burn, but that's just because the whole first book has so much heavy lifting to do to set up a story of that size.
Yeah.
And I guess, it's must be challenging as for an author to balance of they have these grand plans for it. And so you do have to do a lot of setup, but how do you incorporate some type of conclusion in that book one to keep people satisfied, keep people hanging on?
Right.
I don't know. That's a really hard thing to balance.
I got to say, for our Patreon supporter, and thank you to all the patrons out there, Jai Sadai is the one who got us to read your book for the book club. I mean, we do a book club every month with everybody. And just a personal thank you from him. He Greenbone is his second favorite series. Or did it take first to Wheel of Time? It's there. I don't know which one took the cake.
Hey, your spot lines right up with the Wheel of Time. I think that's, at least for me, it's a highest honor.
That is a high honor.
I love Wheel of Time.
But just
as obviously, as you can kind of tell.
But we can thank Jai for getting us to your books and to be able to talk with you, because that's the reason we're here. And that was so cool to read beforehand, because seeing you at Dragonsteel was super cool, that you were on some panels. You were with Dan Wells for the introduction ceremony. How weird was it at maybe it's not weird for you, it's weird for us, but how different was it being at a convention and a bunch of people recognizing you? Was that new? Are you kind of
not new at this point?
But so many recognitions in one spot. Do you get that a lot? Or what is it? When you walk in a bookstore, do you expect someone to walk up to you at this point?
Oh, good Lord. No, not in a bookstore.
No? Okay.
I mean, most of the time, authors were very incognito, because like nobody knows who we are,
right,
which is great. I mean, I can go to the grocery store in my sweatpants. It's fine.
Yeah.
But it really depends on the con and kind of what the attendee body is like. Like I go to comic cons where, you know, much of the attention is on like the film celebrities. Mm. And so I'm just kind of wandering around like any other normal attendee. But you know, a place like Dragonsteel, or I recently went to a book festival in Spain, called Celsius, which is fantastic. But it's all book focused. When I go to a convention that is very focused on books and genre books, that's where it feels like, you know, living the celeb life for a few days, because people will actually recognize you, which is very cool, but means that you're very busy, because you just go like the whole day.
Does that feel like the perfect level of fame, where at certain places you get recognized, but then you can live a normal life outside of that for the most part?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think like I would not. I'm certainly very happy with kind of maxing out on whatever level of fame like sort of a novelist can have, which is just like being recognized by readers within like the specific context of book fandom, which is like its own little world. I mean, there's a reason why most of us writers are writers, which is that like we like being alone in our in our writing cave, working in our pajamas. So that's it's perfect. Just step out of it for like a little bit of fame once in a while, but not too much.
That's a perfect transition to where we had a small game, not really a game of sorts. It's we try to think of something neat and to get to know the author, to get to know our guest a little bit more. And this one, you know, the Myers-Briggs personality test. It's not science whatsoever, but it's a, you know, it's our fun little thing of, oh, who are you? And I guess looking at those four categories, one of the questions is, are you extroverted or introverted? And you would definitely lean on the introversion, it seems like.
I would say, so I'm pretty much, every time I've taken the Myers-Briggs, I fall smack in the middle.
Of everything? Oh, okay.
No.
For that one, okay.
That one specifically.
Got it.
Which means that when I'm in extroverted mode, I'll like go all out and I'll be like, you know, having a great time, enjoying talking to people. And we'll like close down the party. But then afterwards I will want to like be in a room and not talk to anybody for like a couple of days. So yeah, I fall pretty leaning towards the introverted side, but like I fall pretty smack in the middle on that one.
You were talking right before this pod started about doing a writing retreat after Dragonsteel, of how you and some writers went and you ended up just sleeping a lot because of Dragonsteel was so intense. But yeah, doing that, I imagine the writer's life wanting to isolate, but then also when it comes to talking with people, you get that. And so right in the middle, it makes sense. What about for, this is a big one, judging or perceiving? Basically, are you a plotter or pantser? Do you like to make plans, or are you more with the flow?
So why don't you guys guess?
What's that?
Why don't you guys guess?
Okay. I think I know. I think I've got the answer. Rich, do you want to give it a guess?
I know. I'm pretty sure. Fonda, you're a plotter.
You're a plotter. You're definitely a plotter, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
Yeah. No. Absolutely. No.
How much?
That said, I'm not like a I'm not like a super heavy detail outline person.
Yeah.
I usually have an outline, but, you know, it might go out the window somewhere along the way.
Yeah, I've heard the biggest complaint for mainly for plotters, like the reason why pantsers don't like to really detail it out is like once they create a really detailed plot, then plot line, they're just like, why write it now? I've already discovered all the work. And so if you get too in the weeds, then it kills the motivation. That's what I've heard, at least.
From people who are pantsers?
Yeah.
Yeah. What would you say to the thinker or feeler? Are you more logical with your decision making, or do you care about people's feelings? Are you more? I think I know. I got a guess. I think you're more on the logic side.
I do too.
Mm-hmm. Yep. This is good. I'm feeling good. We're able to guess this. This is very cool.
But what is the answer? Yeah. We've been saying what we think.
Well, you said yes to that? More logic?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah. So when you're, how does that work with your writing? When you're going into a character's mind, I guess, not that you go through this test of sorts with your characters, but do you kind of think in your head, hey, is this person more on the, they're more of an empath, or they're more of an analytical decision maker, or how much of your mind goes into the characters and then sprouts from there, if that makes sense?
How much do I analyze them before I write them? Is that kind of the question?
I guess are you not emotionally going like, how would this character feel, but you're kind of being more analytical and planning like, this is how the character would think like this. So I guess, are you more focused on how the character thinks or how the character feels? Because you personally, it seems like you go
like they're very tied together, right? Like, yep. I think like how you process things is always some combination of like your reason and your emotions, right? But like I certainly do consider that particular character's inclinations. Like, are they more likely to react emotionally, or are they more likely to react like rationally with logic? And like, you know, I do that with a lot of my characters, is try to balance them out against each other and to create like interesting dynamics, right? So like Hilo is a very feeling type of person. Like,
yeah, he is.
you know, driven a lot by emotion, but like no one is 100% anything. And like Shay, for example, is clearly the more rational, like, logic-driven type of person. So they create like a juxtaposition, right? And when they have interactions, that's kind of the dynamic. But of course, Shay has a lot of feelings that, and a lot of emotions play into her decisions. They're just a little bit more like under the hood, right? Yeah. And like, of course, Hilo is also extremely calculating. He's like, he's thinking a lot about like, you know, how to politically like outmaneuver his enemies. But that is also kind of shot through with how he personally feels about like people individually. Right. So I guess like the answer to your sort of question was just like, both. But like, I do certainly like think about like the inclinations of the characters, not necessarily always through like a Myers-Briggs lens, but certainly like through their personality and like, how does that play off against characters with different personalities in the story.
For your characters, do you do any kind of like test scenes? Like, because I've heard some authors say like, oh, when I'm figuring out a character, I will write them in certain scenes just to see how they play it.
Yeah.
And then I write the actual book. Do you do any of that? Like, how do you normally plan out these characters?
No, I usually just write it. I mean, there's definitely scenes that turn out to be test scenes because like they get cut. Those right. are like, because like I'll write a character and like the scene won't really go anywhere, but it might have been useful as an exercise to like kind of do a scene with that character, but the scene itself might not be contributing enough to the story for it to stick around. I think most of the time the characters kind of reveal themselves during the course of the writing, and then in revision, that's when I'm like going through and making those characters feel like more true to like who they've become during the course of the story.
There's actually a great clip from Fableman's, exactly what you're, I'm just kidding. Just every segue, just to show the full film.
Apparently everything's
in that movie.
Or Spielberg film that I've never seen. So
it's an enigma.
It's not a great film.
No,
but it's also not a bad film.
Correct. It's I don't think we've okay. This is episode what 190 something. I don't think we've once uttered this film's name. Just something about you provoked the discussion, Fonda. So it's an honor. You're privileged to be experiencing this, is all I'm trying to say.
I will try to take it as such.
So I guess big thing to kind of not summarize, but look at from when we're talking about your personal life versus a bit of fame here and how you world build, all of this comes to terms. When you took that leap to become a writer and now you're able to do this full time, how do you even balance what is your work-life balance like? Because this is fresh, but not totally fresh. You said you quit in 2016, was it?
Roughly. Somewhere there.
You still had most of your career was not being a writer, if that's correct. You were still in the business sphere. So how does this compare to your work-life balance when you were in business versus now as you being more in the creative? Because those are such seemingly opposite professions. So how did that work? What was the juxtaposition like?
So in some ways, it's much better balance. In some ways, it's way worse.
Okay.
So on the plus side, I have a lot more flexibility, right? So as a writer, I don't have a ton of daily deliverables. Like there isn't a boss looking over my shoulder. There isn't like, you know, you gotta be at this meeting at 8 a.m. Like there's most of the time I have a lot of flexibility with my schedule, which has been great, especially because I, you know, was raising kids and so having that flexibility to like pick my kids up from school, to be at their games, like all of that is really great. On the other hand, the balance is terrible because there's no separation between work and life, right? Like as a writer, you never are complete. You're never like checking out and going home because it's just kind of constantly in the background. There's no like clock in and clock out time. Mm-hmm. It's not like and I'm leaving work now and going home and I don't need to think about work for the rest of the evening. There's so much of, especially when, you know, I was, when I was like juggling, you know, my kid's schedule and mine, I still am, but like, there's a lot of like fitting writing into just like these little opportunistic times, like throughout the day. And so you're kind of constantly feeling like you're never working enough, but you're also working all the time. So that it's definitely different. And I think something just to be aware of for anyone who's listening who wants to make that transition into a creative career is that unlike a normal day job, there's not a lot of structure. And that can be like great in some ways, and it can be like very trying in other ways, because there is also no... there's no external benchmark for how you're doing, right? Like there, it feels like you are treading water and you're not getting anywhere. And maybe you've been querying for 2 years with no success, or you've just been working on the same novel for months and months and months and it's going nowhere. And there's no regular performance review by your boss that tells you how you're doing. There's no, like, you're up for promotion now. No, you're just grinding away largely in a solitary, you know, state. And then at some point, someone invites you onto a podcast and says, how did your career move so quickly? And what's the secret to your success? So that's kind of...
Sorry for putting some structure into your schedule, by the way. We knew we said be here 1 o'clock sharp, and you did. So you're still great at maintaining a schedule.
You know, it's because of my MBA training. So that's why I was here right on time. It's like to have... there you go.
Those other writers like Joe Abercrombie. Ugh.
I bet not all of your authors show up right on time.
No, Joe was ours. No, he was he was pretty close. It was
he was 3 minutes later.
Just three. It was no, it was nothing.
Yeah, you have my previous career to thank for that.
Yes, yeah. Thank you very much. I guess have you tried implementing a schedule with your now flexible schedule? Have you tried going, I'm working from this to this, and has that worked? Oh, yeah. If you've done that,
it does definitely work sometimes. So I, at one point I got, just like so frustrated because it was like getting to be, hard to like work at home. And this was like, sure. So I'd written Jade City during the pandemic, which was a challenge. But at a certain point, post pandemic, I was like, I'm so sick of like my usual working places. And I've worked all sorts of places, coffee shop, the library, my home office, you know. So I actually rented a co-working space, like an actual shared office. And I would like leave at a certain time in the morning and go there and like work for a certain number of hours and then come home in the afternoon. So that was like my attempt to make writing more like a day job. And that sometimes works great. Like I actually found it to be very helpful to just create like a physical separation and be like, I am working now. It often, however, gets thrown completely out the window by things like traveling, like Dragonsteel, for example, last week, you know, through the writing schedule way off. Yeah. And then book launch. So I have a book launch coming out in January. So I know January is kind of a write-off because every day has like some interview or some publicity thing. So yeah, it's one of these things where it's like, there's often something more pressing or something that's kind of more immediate. And it's very easy to be like, I've got to do X, Y, Z today. And it's hard to protect that writing time. So I certainly do this. I think a lot of writers that I know do this, which is just like, we're trying to hack our process all the time. We're trying to come up with the trick that'll fool our brains into writing.
That's a great way to put it, because that is true, that writing in your book is not an immediate deadline. That is, it's so far out that you can prioritize, oh, what do I have to do now or by next week? This is due in even 1 month away. That would still take in your mind some priority, especially your business mind going like, okay, this is the deadline I need to hit first. This is the thing I have to do next. What's the best way you found of trying to hack your brain? Is there any other tips or tricks you'd give to people, myself included, just of how to get that right balance?
Oh gosh. I feel like I haven't solved it by any means. It's like, it's still a constant struggle. I mean, the only thing really is that I try to break an overwhelming task down into smaller and smaller pieces. Mm. So, like I'm working on a novel right now that, I'm behind schedule on. And when I look at it, it just feels overwhelming because it's a pretty big revision. The only way I can tackle it is by like break it into smaller pieces, into like down to like, okay, this week I will work on this one chapter. Like I can't see the forest for the trees yet, but like, I know this chapter needs to be fixed in this specific way. So I'm going to, you know, do that. And I know other writers, other advice that I've gotten from, folks who've been where, you know, we all get to as writers, which is like when you feel like you can't handle eating the elephant, you just take one bite at a time, right? Like just make it into as like as minuscule a task as you can. And then eventually you sort of just, it's like stacking sheets of paper. Eventually it'll get there.
You know, I heard a little bit of a rumor during Dragonsteel that, ooh, you know, Sanderson's got that trick down. Apparently after, in between panels and different events he was going to, he apparently was going out to his car or other places and was just writing in between his own convention. That like he would go like be on a panel with you doing the introductions, whatever it was, and then write for an hour or two, and then come on back to the convention. So that guy's figured out.
I don't know if that rumor is true, but if it is, I guess that explains why one reason why he's that prolific. I was certainly not doing any writing in between my panels.
That is, Sanderson definitely has that efficiency down. And I guess you always hear people talking about writer's block, unable to sit down and actually write it. But that is the more interesting part of the conversation, not just the writer's block, but the writing hours is really fascinating to hear just how you find the time to do it. And it seems like you're still striking that balance, but the success you've had so far with all the books you've have written, Greenbone, and et cetera. So clearly something is working. If you had to look back to the first book you ever wrote and when you were juggling both having your day job and writing was just on the side, how did you even manage? Because right now you have not all the time, but your career is writing. Beforehand, when your career was not writing, for those out there that are going, hey, I can't do this full time right now, any advice you would give them when they were in your position of juggling family, work, etc., would you advise something differently to them than to where you are now?
Well, I actually have terrible news, which is that it doesn't actually get any easier.
I'm so sorry.
And that's because as you go on in your career, you get more and more demands on your schedule. Those of you who are like, I have no time to write, I'm juggling my day job, I'm juggling this and that, I can't wait until I go full time. Don't be in such a rush, because actually enjoy this time. Like, this time before you are published, when you are just trying to find time to write, is actually great. Because there are no external, there's no external pressure on you. Like, no one is clamoring for your unwritten debut novel. Nobody knows that you're writing it.
Why do you have to break my heart like that?
Remarkable amount of freedom. Like, think of this as like, you know, almost this position where you're a student. Like, you don't have, no one is expecting you to really be productive yet. And that's actually a great place to be. It means that you can write different things, you can try different things, you can fail at like a project and shelve it, and nobody will care. I mean, now if I shelve a project, there's like contractual issues, right? Like, that are involved. While it's like after you're published, there are a lot more external drivers now. There's like, you know, book contracts, there's deadlines, there's events, there's, in my case, there's travel, there's teaching, there's publicity, there's all this stuff that is just kind of the ancillary work of being an author that you don't have before you're published. So even though it can be really hard to carve out the time, you only have to do that. Like, you just have to write. Like, you don't have to do much else other than be like, I can sit down for, I don't know, 30 minutes, or I can write 500 words today, you know? And I guess I would tell myself, like, back when I was writing my debut novel, and I remember like just having that, like that drive to kind of make it work. Like, enjoy this time. Like, don't be too stressed about it, because you're the only one who's putting stress on yourself right now. You know, wait until other people are putting stress on you, and then.
Well, and which scenario do you find yourself able to write more? The one where there is less stress on you, of, you know, less pressure at your debut novel, versus now where, you know, the lawyers are breathing over your shoulder, breathing on your neck?
I think it was easier to write before, honestly. And I think one reason is because, you know, you don't have any track record yet. So once you do have a track record, then you start thinking about things like, oh, like, is this book, is it brand enhancing? Is it going to, you know, what are my existing readers going to think about it? Is it, like, for example, I have anxiety over the fact that I have a young adult novel coming out, and I'm most well known for my adult fiction, and I have adult fiction projects that I want to be working on. And is this going to be a detour? Like, are people going to come into this book expecting it to be an adult novel, and they'll be like, I didn't want a YA novel. What are you doing, Fonda Lee? Just give me more of this thing that I already like. Mm. You know, so there's those sorts of, those considerations, and also your standards rise. Right. Like, now I'm at the point where I know a lot more about the craft of writing, and I can see the issues with the work as I'm working on it. While as when you're earlier on in your career, there's a certain amount of just like of ignorant happiness that you have just to be doing the work. And you don't kind of see all of the issues with it as clearly. I mean, at this point, I've written a bunch of books, and I've also taught, and I've critiqued a whole lot. So as I'm writing, I can see the problems materialize on the page in front of me, like the second the words are down. Mm. And that can be kind of a paralyzing place to be. So I think it's harder now. It's definitely harder now.
Wow. Yeah. I haven't really thought of that. I've heard the consistent advice is just get your draft one done. You know, just go through it. It's going to be rough. It's going to be bad, but just get it done and then revise, work it out. But I imagine that must be just so much more distracting is during draft one, during your initial writing, you see the problems come up versus, you know, a newer writer that only sees them on, maybe sees them on revision.
Right.
So at least they're not distracted, and they can actually just finish it versus yeah. you're going to be convinced to like, oh, maybe I'll stop.
I genuinely actually hate first drafting. I'm much happier in revision mode because then I'm fixing things. Mm. First drafting just feels like digging myself into a deeper and deeper hole. And that's the part. Writers differ on this. Some people love first drafting and revision is just a giant pain to them. But I'm kind of the opposite.
Tell me your secret on that, because I am the same way where I hate first drafting, but I love editing and revising. Is that just a personality thing that, like you said, specific to certain writers? Is there, what's a way to kind of benefit from that? So you just plow through your first draft and then have a grand old time afterwards?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, you just kind of have to like create like a structure around your first draft that you just like force yourself to do it. Yeah. I mean, for me personally, I find it really helpful to think of the first draft almost as like a zero draft, like lower expectations for your first draft. Like whatever your abysmally low expectations are for your first draft, just lower them even further.
I love it. So, yeah.
I mean, how many chapter ones did you
let's not embarrass
have?
Myself. Too many. Way too many. It's a lesson still learning, but yes. That is, I'm sure you've heard of those everlasting chapter one rewriters. Unfortunately, I'm beyond that, but that was me for a long time. And I know a lot of people out there listening, if they're writing their books, a lot of that trying to be perfect about it and just that urge to fix something when you know it's wrong. And that's part of what you, it's got to be so difficult for you, is even when you're doing those first drafts, now since you're even better at it, as Rich and you were just discussing, you know it's bad initially, but you hopefully you get that relief that you get to fix it later on. And
a side quote. Do you ever write notes while you're doing a draft one or draft zero of like, this I know bad. This is wrong. I'm going to come back to it. Do you have like two things that you're kind of writing?
That's actually helpful because then at least you're kind of marking it. You're just making a note like, okay, I know this needs to be fixed. You know, and the really, parentheses are really helpful, which is like insert great fight scene here.
Have you ever done that?
Oh, yeah.
That is awesome. That is so fun. I guess for everybody listening at home, hopefully this has been helpful for people with writing, also world crafting. How you became famous overnight still stuns us, Fonda. It is.
Oh yeah,
it's incredible.
Like quite literally, you went from what, like Monday released the book, and by like Wednesday afternoon, just overnight success, offered up to Dragonsteel. Like
simple stuff. And I guess to conclude here, for everybody, as always, check out our Patreon in the description below for a book club, our merch, tutoramble.com. Also, use code RAMBLE for World Anvil. Don't forget about them. Thank you for sponsoring this episode. But Fonda, thank you so much for joining us. If you want to conclude with anything of where people can find you and your new book coming out, if you want to say anything to the people at home.
Yeah, I mean, I can be found online. My website's fondalee.com. Super straightforward. These days I'm mostly on Instagram at fonda.lee. And I have a book coming out January 7th. That's a young adult fantasy called Breath of the Dragon. And obviously, if you haven't picked up the Greenbone Saga, please do. And hope your book club enjoys the next two books.
Thank you very much. And awesome. We will have links to everything that Fonda just said down below. Thank you, Rich. Anything? All right, that's it. I was going to cut you off with whatever you're saying anyways.
Fair enough.
Damn it. I missed time that one. I'll have to get better. All right. Fonda, thanks again.
Bye, everyone.
Thank you.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Zaxby's just out Philly'd the Philly again. The Zaxby's Chicken Philly is back with garlic aioli, sautéed peppers and onions, decadent melty cheese, and your choice of Zaxby's signature crispy chicken fingers or delicious grilled chicken. but it's only back for a limited time. So enjoy it while you can. No pressure. It's just the greatest sandwich of all time on a ticking clock. Order the Chicken Philly today. Who's got the sauce? Zaxby's.